Lecture 22, New Standards in English.
Hello, and welcome back to the 18th century. In this lecture, I'm going to be following up on some of the issues I raised in my lecture on Samuel Johnson and his dictionary. In particular, I'm going to look at the relationships between lexicography and linguistic usage. But more generally, I want to go back to a larger issue I raised at the beginning of this course of lectures, the relationship between prescriptivism and descriptivism. Should the study of language prescribe behavior? Should it tell us how we should speak? Or should the study of language describe behavior? That is, should it register the forms and, in effect, leave things as they are? In this lecture in particular, I'm going to focus on two individuals of the late 18th century who raise the pitch of the discussion of prescriptivism and descriptivism. Robert Loth and Joseph Priestley were two scholars, pedagogues, grammarians, and ecclesiasts of the late 18th century. They provide us with information about debates on language use, social propriety, and linguistic relativism. But what they also do is they give us the terms for understanding later developments in the study of the English language, developments that we will see bearing fruit in the Oxford English Dictionary of the 19th century, in our own dictionaries of the 20th century, and in our own current debates on language use and social value. Now, to look at Loth and Priestley means to look at two individuals, each of whom was deeply engaged in the social, religious, and intellectual debates of their time. Robert Loth was a Bishop of London. He was educated at Oxford University, and he was a key figure in the religious and educational establishment in England in the second half of the 18th century. He was the author of many works, one of which in particular was The Principles of English Grammar. It was first published in 1762, and it was revised many times until 1787. Now, Loth was what we might call a prescriptivist. That is, he argued that the study of language should prescribe linguistic behavior in individual speakers and writers. He said, among other things, that his goal was, and I quote, to teach what is right by teaching what is right and wrong. He developed a notion of grammar, which was in effect essential to a language. I'd like to read a selection from his Principles of English Grammar. This is from the 1787 revised edition. And Loth wrote, quote, "Grammar is the art of rightly expressing our thoughts by words. Grammar in general, or universal grammar, explains the principles which are common to all languages. The grammar of any particular language, as the English grammar, applies those common principles to that particular language according to established usage and custom of it." Now, what makes this a prescriptivist dictum? Central to Loth's prescriptivism is the notion of right and wrong. Grammar here is not a universal category of making relationships of syntax or of meaning. Grammar is not a habit of mind. Grammar is, he says, the art of rightly expressing our thoughts by words. And it's this notion of rightness or correctness, which is key to Loth's theory, as it were, of grammar. Common principles, he says, are applied to a particular language according to established usage and custom. One cannot but look back on Loth from our perspective and see a word like established as reflecting the establishment principles, the social hierarchies of a man who educated at Oxford, served as Bishop of London. And furthermore, Loth will go on, that we should apply, he claims, the principles of Latin grammar to English. In other words, what interests Loth is using the template of Latin grammatical education to explain English grammatical forms. And as I will illustrate in a few minutes, one of the things that Loth is very much concerned with is finding exact equivalents between English grammatical uses and Latin grammatical uses. In particular, the idea of tense. Can we, for example, have a subjunctive mood or a past participle in English? Can we have an ablative absolute in English, where these categories indicate precise Latin grammatical categories? Let me turn now to Joseph Priestley. Joseph Priestley was not an Englishman, but he was a Scot. He was an empiricist. He was a scientist. He was one of the discoverers of oxygen. He was one of the founders of Unitarianism. And he eventually moved from England to the United States. Priestley was the author of a widely read textbook called The Rudiments of English Grammar. It was first published in 1761. It was revised in 1772, and it was reprinted throughout the 1770s and 1780s. Just take, for example, the very titles of the works, Principles for Loth and Rudiments for Priestley. Principles indicates guidelines of behavior. Rudiments indicates the basics. Priestley is, as I mentioned, an empiricist. He is in many ways a follower of Hume. As someone who is an experimental scientist, he's interested in deducing general principles from observation, rather than developing larger principles first and then applying them to the observed world. He is, in effect, a descriptivist. One of the phrases that he uses, one of the idioms he uses, is to say that language, like water, will seek its own natural level. He considered grammar not an essential quality of language, but rather a collection of observations on the structure of it. Let me read a passage from his Rudiments, and here I quote from the 1772 edition. Priestley said that language is a method of conveying our ideas to the minds of other persons. And the grammar of a language, he says, is a collection of observations on the structure of it and a system of rules for the proper use of it. This notion of grammar as a collection of observation is different from Loth's notion of grammar as the art of rightly expressing. Furthermore, as a scientist, Priestley is interested in observing the data of the English language. Now, just because Priestley is an empiricist and a descriptivist does not necessarily mean that he did not have ideas of his own about what constituted the best or the truest in English language usage. For example, Priestley favored the elimination of what he called Gallicisms from the English language. In effect, he follows Samuel Johnson, who was a great influence on him, in trying to remove what he saw as affected words from French. Moreover, he's interested in what he calls the true idiom of English. He's interested in what he calls the genius of the English language. And yet, writing in the 1760s and revising his textbook in the 1770s, Priestley is not unaware of the political implications of language study. An excellent quotation from this revised 1772 edition is the following. He says, "I think it not only unsuitable to the genius of a free nation, but in itself ill-calculated to reform and fix a language." Listen to this. In the 1770s, unsuitable to the genius of a free nation. What is the free nation of the 1770s? How do you read a text like this, enmeshed in the political controversies of revolution and reform, of political debate, of the very notion of freedom, which in subsequent lectures in part three of this series we will see as central to the American conception of linguistic uniqueness. How can we understand Priestley now, not just as a describer of language, but as a politician, someone developing an ideology of freedom and, as it were, description as a way not of fettering, but of releasing the language, the genius of a nation. Now, one of the key issues that emerges in this debate is not simply what is right and wrong, but what is proper and improper. I would like to pause for a little bit to spend some time talking about the word propriety. Propriety is a very important word in the 18th and 19th centuries, in particular in the way in which it illustrates a shift from linguistic to social usage. Building on some terms that I developed earlier and looking ahead towards a future lecture on semantic change, we can say that the word propriety undergoes in its history an extension in lexis. That means that the word changes, as it were, by adding on metaphorical or figurative meanings from its original literal, concrete, or physical set of connotations. The word propriety originally refers to physical or commercial, or one might even say property uses. Indeed, the word property inheres in the word propriety. If you were to go to Johnson's Dictionary, first published, you'll remember, in 1755, and look up the word propriety, what you would get as the first definition would be the following: peculiarity of possession or exclusive right. Definition 2 in Johnson gives us the following: accuracy, justness, especially in a linguistic sense. Now, we no longer use the word propriety in this linguistic sense. You will remember that one of the innovations of Johnson's dictionary was to illustrate aphoristic definitions with quotations from literary texts. And in particular, Johnson liked to use not just the works of the poets or the prose writers of English imaginative fiction, but he also liked to use the writings of philosophers, intellectual texts, writings of Hume, and also of Locke, the founders of the British empiricist philosophical tradition. And in this second definition of propriety in Johnson's dictionary, we get an illustrative quotation from John Locke, and I quote, "Common sense, that is the rule of propriety, affords some aid to settle the signification of language." Now, what I think Locke means, and I think what Johnson means by invoking Locke here, is the idea that propriety or justness or accuracy is about grammatical categories. It's about agreement among subject and verb. It's about the proper uses of certain kinds of grammatical forms in expressing oneself justly. It does not, I believe, at this time refer to issues of social propriety or issues of literacy as we might connote it today as a marker of social accomplishment. Rather, I believe that this is a grammatical category, and when Locke says common sense, that is the rule of propriety, what I think Locke is referring to is the way in which we almost intuitively or commonsensically recognize that certain forms are grammatical or proper, and certain forms are ungrammatical or improper. This is, as it were, the genealogy of descriptivism that begins with Locke, that moves through Johnson, and that finds its later 18th century articulation in Priestley. So when we look at a word like propriety, we're looking at issues of what we might call grammatical concord. Loth uses the word propriety when he talks about the rule of propriety in affording, as it were, the problem of grammatical concord, when he talks about making language meaningful. Now, I'm going to quote a little from Loth here. Loth is discussing the problem of what he calls the subjunctive mood. Now, the subjunctive in Latin is a form of a verb which indicates counterfactuals, or it indicates wish, or it indicates something that might be. And in modern English, we indicate forms of the subjunctive often using modal or helping verbs. Oh, or would, for example. Let me give you an example of the subjunctive. Would that it were sunny today. Or we might use the subjunctive. Would that you were listening to me clearly. Subspecies of the subjunctive mood there. Now, in Latin, the subjunctive would be indicated by an actual change in the word, by part of the conjugation of a verb. And this is what Loth is interested in. In other words, do English verbs on their own have a subjunctive? So here, Loth is writing about the subjunctive mood, and he says, shall we, in deference to these great authorities, that is, to writers on Latin grammar, allow wert, the English word wert, to be the same with wast, and common to the indicative or the subjunctive mode? Or, Loth goes on, should we rather abide by the practice of our best ancient writers, the propriety of the language, which requires, as far as may be, distinct forms for different modes, and the analogy of formation in each mode, I was, thou wast, I were, thou wert, all of which conspire to make work peculiar to the subjunctive mode. Okay, now what's going on in this very complicated quotation? The issue here for Loth is there a subjunctive that adheres in English? The indicative, just the everyday expression, is I was, thou wast. This is the way that Loth wants to see it. What Loth wants to do is argue that I were functions as the true subjunctive. Not, I existed in a condition in the past, or I was doing something, but I were. That is a counterfactual, a statement contrary to fact, a statement of wish. Were I going to school today, so on and so on and so on. This is the expression of the subjunctive. Loth considers this extremely technical discussion, as it were, under the rubric of what he calls the propriety of language. And this issue of propriety for Loth is an issue not of social use, but an issue of highly technical grammatical use. At the end of the 18th century, the word propriety, I believe, becomes a touchstone for the relationships of the purely linguistic to the social. When we look at propriety as a grammatical issue, as an issue of accuracy, of expression, or of proper grammatical forms or endings, we naturally will see this linguistic propriety applied to social issues. When Johnson writes in the preface to the 1755 dictionary that the illiterate, and I quote, forget propriety, what he means is that they do not accurately express the grammatical relationships among words. But how can we not already imbue the concept of propriety with a social issue in a statement like that? Later on, a generation later, Fanny Burney, one of the great arbiters of social taste and decorum in the 18th century, would write, in the year 1784, such propriety of mind as can only result from the union of good sense and virtue. Now, propriety here is a feature of mind. It's an issue of common sense, now becoming good sense. Remember Locke's definition as quoted in Johnson. Locke talked about common sense, that is the rule of propriety. Fanny Burney is now talking about good sense. From common sense to good sense, from something that inheres in everybody to something that, as it were, percolates up to the social elite. Good sense and virtue. You'll remember the word virtue from Chaucer, vertu, coming from the Latin and the French, vir, a particular and uniquely masculine term. in Chaucer keyed to problems of engenderment, to issues of power, to issues of a distinctively masculine social set of categories. By the end of the 18th century, however, virtue can apply to all forms of social behavior, and in particular at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century, to issues of female social behavior. Virtue rewarded, a concept applied in the 18th century novel to female behavior, and in particular to chastity. Good sense, common sense, virtue, these are now moral categories that inflect the term propriety. In the late 18th century, a word like propriety becomes the marker of exactly this nexus of the linguistic, the social, and the moral. Thomas Stern's Sentimental Journey, which was published in the 1760s, uses the word propriety to describe precisely these social categories, the high gloss, as it were, of contemporary life. But what's fascinating, it seems to me, about the way Stern uses the word is that he doesn't use the word in English at all. He uses the word in French, propreté. And in fact, if you look at it in a modern edition, it will always be italicized or highlighted as a French loanword. It is as if the very concept in the 1760s of propriety as a social category is not quite fully filtered in to English. And Stern must signal this by using it as a self-consciously French or loan word in his language. By the beginning of the 19th century, in the novels of Jane Austen, propriety becomes now fully the category of social behavior. One can argue that the novels of Jane Austen are novels of propriety, not just because she limns the contours of social behavior or of decorum in public and private life, but because the very theme of Austen's novels is the correct application, as it were, of linguistic categories to social categories to moral categories. Austen's novels that begin with such maxims, it is a truth universally acknowledged. Austen's novels that move so purposefully and almost relentlessly to the marriage plot, to the union of man and woman. Austen's novels that are so concerned with finding the right mate for man and woman. Novels like Pride and Prejudice, novels like Emma, these are novels that, it might say, take the idea of propriety as a grammatical or linguistic category and narrate out the possibilities of social propriety and decorum. One could even argue that so much of Austen's novels are about taking the idea of concord, a grammatical category, of agreement, a grammatical category, of propriety, a grammatical category, and now seeing them as social categories, too. So concord is no longer about the agreement between a noun and a verb, but concord is about social amity and the agreement between a husband and a wife. It seems to me that what's at stake in so much of the early 19th century novel and its late 18th century social and intellectual precursors is precisely the way in which grammatical categories become templates for social categories. Or to put it more generally, social behavior finds itself modeled on linguistic behavior. The history of the English language becomes the history of English mores. In this mix of the linguistic and the social, we cannot but see then a certain set of arbitrations. In my earlier lecture on Johnson's dictionary, I noted how Johnson was one of the first lexicographers systematically to distinguish between the proper or the elevated and the slang and the colloquial. I gave you some examples. Swap, twiddle, twaddle, wobble, budge, coax, and touchy. Now, these are low words for Johnson, not just because they may be slang or they may be dialect, but in particular because they are monosyllables, they are reduplicating or onomatopoetic terms. Now, this is very important. The idea that a verbal category can be described not just by the individuals who use the word, but by the very sound or by the quality of the word. Conversely, I mentioned a word like chaperone, which Johnson sees as a French or Gallic affectation. On the one hand, low words, on the other hand, affected words. Johnson is seeking, in effect, a kind of middle ground. Now, when we see certain kinds of words operating, we will see in works like the Oxford English Dictionary the legacy of what we might call Johnsonian linguistic and social arbitration. When we look, for example, at a word like ain't, we're going to be looking at a word that's not simply bad or colloquial or slang, but one whose history writes out a literary and a social narrative of belonging and exclusion. Or when we look at two highly technical words, words like quiz or protocol in the Oxford English Dictionary, we're also going to be looking at the legacies of Johnson in some fundamental ways. Let me just anticipate a little bit. A word like quiz seems to us to be perfectly transparent. A verb, to quiz, to inquire, to be inquisitive, perhaps. A noun, a test. A short examination based on material. Yet, as we will see, the Oxford English Dictionary is very awkward and very unsure about the etymology of the word quiz. It does not want to associate it with good usage, but with folk etymology, or with, as it were, anecdote, which cannot be proven. Protocol, by contrast, is a highly technical term. It has a Greek etymology, proto-colophon, the thing that came before the colophon, something in the beginning, in some sense, in a text. It's a term of diplomatic usage. It's a term of social behavior. What are the protocols of diplomacy? What are the protocols of government? Yet, in this case, the Oxford English Dictionary, as we will see, writes out a narrative very much in another Johnsonian mode. A narrative now not of a word that is low or slang or onomatopoetic, but a word that is affected, a word that is French, a word that does not apply to proper English usage. Indeed, the OED will say again and again that a word like protocol forms no part of English usage. We need to pause over this because we need to see the legacy of these 18th century debates as informing, or one might go so far as to say, as even writing the script for 19th and 20th century linguistic discussions. When we read a dictionary, whether it's an old dictionary like Johnson's, a scholarly dictionary like the Oxford English Dictionary, or a modern dictionary, a Webster or an American Heritage Dictionary, we are looking at narratives of social use and grammatical propriety. I'd go so far as to argue that what is important about the material I've presented in this lecture is not just that it tells us attitudes towards 18th and 19th century language, not just that it gives us a sense of the history of English, but it gives us the terms of our own debates. When we read a dictionary today, what we're looking at is the encoded legacy of these arguments. When we look up the definition of a word, we're looking at the legacy of Samuel Johnson. Let me just review briefly. Johnson, who organized definitions by moving from the literal to the metaphorical, even if the literal was no longer the primary social or everyday use of the word. Moreover, the idea of the aphoristic definition, the idea of the literary quote, was a Johnsonian innovation. When we look at literary quotations, or when we look at examples that are used, we also therefore must read behind them. What is the story being told in a list of quotes and definitions? How does the dictionary adjudicate between prescriptivism and descriptivism? We look for a dictionary, and we look in a dictionary for many, many things. But I think what we look for in particular is affirmation not just of how we should speak, but of how we ordinarily speak as well. For in the narrative of lexicography is the narrative of the self. Johnson defined lexicography, you'll remember, as a harmless drudge. And the humor or the wit or the pathos of Johnson's dictionary lies so often in the illustrations he will use for certain words. We too look for affirmation of the self in every dictionary and in every work of grammar. And in my subsequent lectures that will close this second part of this series on the history of the language, I'm going to be looking at attitudes and idioms that give us ways of understanding selves and surfaces of selves in order to understand the relationship of individuality to society. Are we proper or improper? Do we understand the way in which we function by reading the grammar book? And in reading the grammar book, are we also learning something about society, about mind, and about good and bad behavior in the large? Thank you.